We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This morning, both hours of the program deal with the issue of water. And this program today, actually, I think is a good example of the way that one show can lead to another. A couple of weeks ago, we had some people here on the program who were involved in the East Central Illinois Water Supply Planning Committee. And they have been involved in this effort. It's been going on now for a couple of years to look at the way we use water here in East Central Illinois, where it comes from, and how we can make sure that that resource continues to be used in a sustainable way so that everybody gets to use it, but we don't end up exhausting the resource. And we heard from some people after the program and said, well, that's all very interesting. But there are some things here we think it'd be worth talking some more about. One is the way the water use is regulated. And in fact, as we'll talk about here, it's actually hardly regulated at all. The person who contacted us said, well, I'll tell you who I think you should have on the program. You should have Eric Freifogel, who's professor of law here at the University of Illinois. And we said, well, yeah, of course, he would be the guy, wouldn't he? And we called him, and he said, yes, he'd be very happy to come over and talk with us. He's been here on the program before. He's the author or editor of a number of books dealing with issues of humans and nature. He's written about conservation thought. He's written about property rights. He has a brand new book that's the first ever overview of all of American wildlife law. And this particular issue is one that he's interested in, has thought about, written about. We've talked about it here on the program, and we're pleased to have him back. Questions certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. We just ask people to try to be brief so we can keep moving along, get in as many callers as possible. But questions are certainly welcome. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
I appreciate it. To start, actually, in the second part of the program, we'll be talking with a fellow who has done a lot of writing about water issues. His name is Robert Glennon, and he teaches at University of Arizona. He was actually here on the program before and has a new book out that looks at water use in the country. And the reason that I raise that is that he uses an image that I think is very apt, and it's a good thing to start us off. And he says, imagine, you know, think of the water supply like a big soda glass, and that people are coming along and they're putting in straws to draw out the water. He says that most places around the country, there's no law determining how many straws can be put in the glass. And that's the problem, that we're continuing to put straws in the glass, more and more people drawing out the water, and that there's really almost no government involvement in determining how many straws you can put in the glass. Is that pretty much the way that it is?
I think it is, yes, right.
And this is something that when we had this last program, it came up a couple of times, and I think maybe people were almost a little bit surprised to hear that that is the case, that water, you know, water quality, we have laws about that, but water use is essentially unregulated.
Sure, it is unregulated. I wonder if I can sort of take things back a step, though,
sure.
Because
yeah.
Before you get to the issue of regulating use, you might ask, who has the right to use it? In parts of the country, in order to use water, you have to go to the government and get a permit. And if the government's running well, it will limit the number of permits, limit the number of water that can be withdrawn in the public interest. I mean, that's the ideal, of course. In some jurisdictions, permits are granted on sort of a first-in-time basis. You know, whoever is first to show up and ask for it gets the water, and then when there's no water left, no more permits are given out. That's not the approach that Illinois takes. It's not the approach that is taken in really the eastern half of the country, east of the Mississippi. In Illinois, we view water as part of the land itself, so that when you buy land, along with it comes not just the soil and the trees and the right to use the airspace and the minerals underground, but also comes with it a right to use water. In theory, the water actually is owned by the people collectively. The landowner doesn't own the water, just like landowners don't own wildlife. Wildlife is also owned collectively. That what you get as a landowner is a right to make reasonable use of the water that either flows on the surface across your land or adjacent to your land, or that flows beneath the surface. So we just sort of packaged water together with land, and then so as people acquired land, they got with it a right to use the water. It is limited only by a fairly vague doctrine of reasonableness.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can talk about that in a moment. Let me then ask the question, where does that approach to the resource come from? Is that a very old idea?
Oh, indeed. Yes, it is. Our legal system, for the most part, we inherited from England. It's the English common law system. And that was basically the idea that prevailed in England. England, by the way, is a fairly humid country with lots of rivers, lots of water. I mean, there's no particular shortage. So this is not a legal approach toward water that anticipates shortages or that's intended to divide up water among competing uses to make sure that the most socially beneficial or economically productive uses get the water to the exclusion of others. It's a regime intended for a humid country where conflicts would be rare.
Yeah. And I suppose in other places where water is scarce, the approach is very different.
As in the American West, yes, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And around the world generally. I mean, the notion that you get water with land isn't automatically obvious, just like it isn't automatically obvious that you would get, when you buy land, the right to the minerals beneath the surface. In the United States, we take it for granted that if you buy land, you get the coal and the oil and so on, and unless it's been severed. That is not the norm around the world generally, by the way. I mean, normally oil is reserved by the state or coal may be allocated separately. So it's one of the interesting broader issues in natural resources law generally.
So theoretically, you buy a piece of land, you get – not only do you get what you're standing on, you get everything that goes down as far as it goes?
Yes. That notion sort of crept into the law into the 18th and 19th centuries. I wouldn't push it too far because there's a lot of interesting legal issues that arise there. What about a subterranean cave? You know, who controls access to a cave? And do you own a cave that might be beneath your land even if you have no way of access to it? That issue is coming up a lot with respect to geothermal resources, for instance. I mean, there's more and more things underground. I wish we could talk at length about the issues of carbon storage underground, because that again raises an issue about who has rights to use the subsurface and whether or not this idea that you introduced that if you own the surface, you control everything that goes on beneath it. That isn't – I guess I would say that that's an idea that is in the law, but there's lots of exceptions to it, particularly in the American West.
Right. So we have this this idea, this principle that says if you own a piece of land and if a stream flows through it or even if it's adjacent or there is groundwater, you drill a well, mm-hmm. that you are entitled to – quote unquote, reasonable use
exactly.
of that water. So then that gets to the more difficult issue of what is reasonable use.
Indeed. The main thing to say about it is a vague notion, obviously. Reasonableness would be determined by looking at a lot of different factors. One point that is often overlooked and that even many lawyers don't appreciate is that in its classic form, the reasonable use doctrine in groundwater law limits your use of water to the tract of land where the water is extracted, meaning you can pump it from your land, but it then has to be used on the overlying land. It's a strict place of use rule. There are some states that have relaxed that a little bit. But as I say, in the classic form, you were limited to place of use, and Illinois has no precedents that suggest that that rule has been relaxed. It is a rule that is widely violated, by the way, particularly by municipalities. Here in Champaign-Urbana, our water comes out of wells in distinct locations. It's owned by the water company, but then they immediately pump it off their land for use elsewhere. And that would be per se unreasonable at least if there is some other groundwater user who is directly harmed by it. I mean, more could be said about that. But so reasonable is there's this place of use rule. It isn't really real clear how many factors are taken into account in evaluating the reasonableness of uses. When cases came up in the 19th century, most courts viewed groundwater as just a mystery. They didn't understand interconnection. They didn't understand recharge or flows. And so they were really unsure whether pumping by one landowner really was adversely affecting somebody else. And so they typically judge the reasonableness of a water use in isolation. They sort of looked at what you were doing. You know, is it sort of reasonably efficient? Is it productive? Are you putting it to some decent use? If yes, then your use would be reasonable pretty much without regard to the effects that you had on other pumpers just because they couldn't be determined. Now we know a lot more about hydrology and are much better able to determine who is harming whom. And I'm guessing if cases came up today, and they are very rare, by the way, if cases came up, there would be more of an inclination to look at whether pumping by one person was adversely affecting somebody else.
Just let me ask you one follow-up question, then I have a caller here I want to get to. When we did this other program, I just raised the somewhat facetious example. I said, well, you know, if I went out in the county and I bought a piece of property and I drilled a well and I started pumping water and bottling it, could I then set up my own bottled water company and go out and sell that? Now, it sounds from what you're saying is that would not satisfy that would violate the reasonable use standard because I wasn't using it there on my property.
It might. That certainly would be an issue. But as I say, this place of use rule is widely violated by all sorts of other people. So if the people complaining are themselves also violating the rule, it's going to be hard for them to press the claim. Now, whether you could set up a bottled water company, of course, raises legal issues beyond groundwater. You know, business regulation generally, but just focusing on could you pump the water out for that purpose, it really would go down to the reasonableness of it. What factors would be relevant? Well, possibly the amount of land you have. If you bought just a few acres of land for a well and are extracting a huge amount of water for a few acres, somebody could easily say, well, gee, you're taking more than your fair share. If fair share is based upon acreage, you know, you're extracting way too much based on your fair share. It isn't clear, by the way, that fair share is terribly relevant in groundwater law in Illinois. There are some versions of groundwater law in California, for instance, what they call a correlative rights approach, where they really look at how many acres you have vis-a-vis all the land over an aquifer, and they sort of divide it up on that basis. Not clear to what extent fair share notions would come in. So who knows? I don't, it would be risky. In fact, that's worth talking about maybe later in the hour that the vague rule we have has a lot of practical implications to it. If you want to invest in plant and equipment with a long useful life and want to go into a business where you really need a secure long-term source of water, this is it's dicey for you here because at any time somebody could come along and challenge your use and say it's unreasonable and you could be shut down. Mm. So it adds insecurity for potential water users. On the other side, for you know local communities or citizen groups of some sort, it's hard for them to know whether they can successfully stop a water use because of the same vagueness.
Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580 is Eric Freifogel. He's professor of law at the University of Illinois College of Law, teaches courses in environmental law and natural resources law. And we're talking this morning here about water, kind of specifically about groundwater, but we are talking about the larger question of who owns natural resources here, water resources in particular. And as I explained at the beginning, this was a program that kind of sprang out of a recent show that we were doing, looking at the effort to try to get a better understanding of where the water comes from in our area, who's using it, how much they're using, and how to use that in a sustainable way. And some questions like this came up, and I said, well, we need a natural resource lawyer, and this is the guy. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have some other callers here. We'll start us off with someone in Belgium, line four, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you both. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of three questions. I hope I don't overload the situation. But one, a quick one here that you can answer very quickly. If I own both sides of a stream, therefore I own the water. I own the rights for the water to pass by my piece of property. At what point and how much can I control that water? Now, Can I control it so I can stop the flow downstream? No, that probably is not right. Can I control it to the point that I can't allow people to move across the stream? Well, I'm not sure that's right either. If you see, I'm talking about two or three different aspects of the water, whether you travel on it or whether you use it, whether you use it for generating power and let it move on, if you see what I'm saying there. The other question I have is, and I've worked for people who extract huge volumes of water from ground water tables at levels of about 800 feet deep. So it's not really surface water in any way, shape, or form. It's very old water, deep water. But they extract it, and then they just dump it back into a river without really doing too much cleaning of it and stuff, and use it for their processes and things. And that has a certain effect. And then the third and last question I'd like you to address is, there are various industries, and there's one that's beginning to be thought about in our area here, is what are the situations when you want to inject something back down into the earth? Over here in East Central Illinois, there used to be a corporation that made Genetron, which is a freon-type compound. It's no longer used. It's no longer produced anymore. They no longer do it. But while they were producing it, they injected deep into the earth, 800,000 feet in the ground, they injected some of their wastewater. Now, that wastewater that went in will have an effect on other waters at some point in time. I have no idea. But what are the laws of those three things? You know, how is water controlled when you own the access across your property? What rights do you have to suck out so much that you're causing problems, and then somebody else putting something in that might affect all three of them?
That's probably enough to keep us going for the rest of the hour. We'll see what we can do.
I think we can cover most of them pretty quickly. We've been talking about groundwater law. The same reasonable use rule, though, applies to surface water. You can make reasonable use of water going by your property. Reasonableness, looking at all of the factors. Typically, you can't block it. Actually, blocking waterways, though, is pretty extensively regulated at the federal level and to some extent at the state level. Now, the issue about access to the surface of the water is an entirely different legal doctrine. All of our waterways are governed by multiple legal rules that keep them open to public use, certainly if they are at all navigable. That issue is a complex one. A lot of people think it is determined solely by state law, but that's not right. There's lots of federal laws that keep our waterways open for public use. In Illinois, I think it is all waterways that are at all remotely navigable, and that probably means by recreational craft. There are a number of states in the country, though, where every waterway is open without regard to navigability. So, yes, landowners need to be very careful, because actually there's a federal criminal statute that prohibits you from blocking a waterway in any sense, not that people get prosecuted on it. But our waterways are very much open. With respect to pulling water out from deep beneath, 800 feet below the surface, you're saying they're dumping it into the river. Well, that raises two issues. Dumping something into a river, you're adding a pollutant to it, and that would be governed by the Clean Water Act, so they would need a pollution discharge permit for that. Even if they really are altering it only in trivial ways, I mean, even if they're only altering the temperature of it, actually temperature, heat, or altering the temperature in any way is a pollutant, so they would need a permit for that. But the fact that it's 800 feet below the surface, that's still part of the reasonable use rule on groundwater application. So again, their use would have to be judged by its overall reasonableness. And as I've said, that's a pretty vague standard. As far as injecting stuff into the earth, that really is a use of the subsurface. I thought the hypothetical you were giving me here was going to involve somebody putting something in the ground who then wants to retrieve it. And actually, if you put something into the ground, storing it underground, like natural gas or something, or oil, and intend to retrieve it, you are actually making use of other people's subsurface, and that's trespassing, and you have to pay for that. You have to get a lease of the ability. The hypothetical you've given me, though, took a turn. It was actually wastewater, meaning they're abandoning it. They're throwing it away. That might not be regulated in any way. I mean, pollution of surface water, heavily regulated. Pollution of groundwater, not particularly regulated unless it is fairly close to a groundwater well. then it's covered by the Safe Drinking Water Act.
Okay. Well, I hope that gets to the questions.
Sort of quick, but those are great questions, by the way.
And we're getting close to our midpoint here. We have some others, so I want to go next to Sycamore. This is line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I'm very interested in your topic this morning because I use groundwater as a heat source for a geothermal heat pump system to run my house. And I am one of the few people I know that uses, that actually returns the water discharge from the furnaces back to the water table. A number of systems that I've heard of, they simply throw the water onto the surface and become the head end of a creek or put it into a creek. But we actually drilled a second well and put the water back down into the water table after altering only its temperature. And my concern, of course, is that at some time in the future this might be regulated. Right now, all I had to do was register the well with the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency, and all they really wanted to know was its geographic coordinates. Where is this well located? So I'll be interested to hear your answer.
I guess you're asking me to speculate. Might there be some regulation in the future of what you're doing because you're changing the temperature? No crystal ball here. It seems unlikely to me, though, because the reason we're concerned about temperature in surface waters is because so much aquatic life in the river is affected by the temperature. Illinois waterways are not terribly sensitive. We don't have a lot of cold water fisheries, and therefore our temperature standards are not terribly protective of them. There are states like Oregon. I mean, the main water quality standard most often violated is the temperature standard because they have so many valuable fisheries that are dependent upon keeping water temperatures quite cool. So that's sort of the main issue. I don't know enough about groundwater to know whether anybody would be concerned about a slight increase in temperature in groundwater, whether that would have any ecological effect of some sort. I mean, obviously, pretty soon the heat is going to dissipate, and you know, you're right down to the surrounding temperature level. So I don't see it as unless I'm missing something. I don't see it as a problem that would lead to some regulation.
Well, what is comforting to me to think about is that in the wintertime, of course, we're actually sending cooler water back down because we're extracting heat out of it by about 10 degrees. Mm-hmm. And in the summertime, we're sending warmer water down there. But on average, it probably actually winds up being pretty similar. But it's a great system, and we're very happy with the way it works.
It does sound like a good system.
And it's of course, very green because it doesn't cause any greenhouse gases of any sort other than, and I guess we get our power from the Byron nuclear power plant, so we don't even generate any greenhouse gases to make the electricity. So we're very happy with the system,
good.
But always wonder, you know, if what we're doing is going to be regulated someday.
All right. Well, I guess that the best answer we get for you is probably not, but of course we don't know.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Let's come back here to a caller in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello. I have a question that it seems that most of these studies that have come out about the Mahomet Aquifer recently show that the water that our water company pumps out or our county pumps out is being sucked in from surrounding counties like Vermilion and Piatt. And it's also reducing the flow in the Sangamon River that would otherwise go to Decatur because the water goes down into the aquifer, gets sucked down by the Kona Depression. And I was just wondering if our water company might be vulnerable to getting sued by these other counties or water companies in those counties and stuff, because it just seems unreasonable to me, but what does the law say about it? I've got a bad connection here, so I'm going to hang up and just listen on the phone.
All right. Well, thanks for I think the question's clear. What do you think?
Oh, sure. I don't know that there is any standard other than this vague reasonableness standard that would apply here. The facts you give, though, do highlight a problem in our law, and that is the disconnect between groundwater law and surface water law. The law, in its infinite wisdom, sort of assumes that these are two independent water sources and that they can be governed and the water allocated independently of one another. Of course, that isn't true. Groundwater and surface water are very connected. Obviously, there's a lot of deep underground water that isn't hydrologically connected to the surface around here. But people who have more shallow wells are, of course, sucking water out and lowering water tables and, in a sense, pulling water out from the rivers. Surely the day will come when Illinois awakens to this reality and does something about it. It's certainly talked a lot about the need to integrate groundwater and surface water. The reasonable use doctrine could actually take this into account, and some states have done that. That is, they look at the reasonableness of a groundwater use by taking into account the effect that it has on surface streams as well. Mm-hmm. And surely if a groundwater pumper is pulling enough water out of a river so that it starts violating water quality standards, adversely affecting aquatic life, interfering with other reasonable uses of water on the river, that could lead a court to conclude that the groundwater pumping is unreasonable. But at the moment, we just have this very vague standard. And, your comment might be right. You know, if it went to litigation, a court might well say that Champaign-Urbana Water Company is acting unreasonably by taking too much water out.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Eric Freifogel. He's a Max T. Rowe Professor of Law in the College of Law here at the University of Illinois, and he teaches and writes about things like environmental law and conservation thought and natural resources law. And we're talking about the question of who owns water resources and what the law says about that. This is something, again, it's come out of a program we did recently looking at the effort to try to map out, understand who uses water here in the East Central Illinois, where that water comes from, and how to best to manage that resource in a sustainable way. And someone said, well, they were interested in hearing a little bit more about what the law says about use. And we thought, well, Eric Freifogel was the guy to call, and he's here with us, and we'll be happy to take questions. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Just to get back just for a moment to this to the reasonable use principle, you talked about the fact that the law says if you own property, then you have the right to what's underneath it, and if there's water there, you can drill a well and you can pump water, and that it is regulated by this very sort of vague notion of reasonable use. You're entitled to reasonable use, whatever that means. So if supposing that I decide my neighbor is making unreasonable use, he's pumping too much, what mechanism is there for this to be adjudicated?
Alas, not a very good one. About all you could do, frankly, would be to go to court and file a lawsuit challenging it. Lawsuits, of course, are time-consuming. They're very expensive. This kind of litigation could be particularly time-consuming and expensive because there would be so much evidence that might well be relevant to this. You'd have to demonstrate that your neighbor's pumping is actually interfering with what you're doing. And that could be difficult. It's conceivable the suit might go pretty easily if your neighbor has drilled something unduly deeply and has a cone of depression around the well, and that's the reason why your well has gone dry. That might be labeled unreasonable pretty promptly. But it is not a good dispute resolution mechanism. And if you were backing away from our legal regime generally, that's one of the criticisms you would make of it, is that there isn't a good prompt way to make decisions about this. And it's hugely burdensome on an individual landowner to have to hire some hydrogeologist or something to come in and do studies. I mean, the meter's running. This is thousands and thousands of dollars. Even to find out anything. That's before you bring the lawyers in. So it's if we were going about reforming our system, we would want a much better dispute resolution mechanism. Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, it would be up to a court and a judge to make that decision as to what is reasonable use.
Sure. And that's going to be a seat of the pants determination. I mean, there's just no hiding the fact that reasonableness is so vague that people's opinions are going to differ. So it in part comes down to who's making the decision. Yeah. It's a rule of by people, not by objective laws.
And so for all of these reasons, because the standards are vague, because it's complicated and cumbersome, because to file and carry out such a suit it would be very expensive, it sounds as if that's why you're saying it almost never happens. People just don't do it.
Yeah, litigation over groundwater usage is very rare. It's going to be coming. You know, I mean, we've got shortages developing, but the number of cases, particularly things that go up to the appellate or state Supreme Court level resulting in rulings, are very rare. I mean, we have not, I believe this is still the case, we have not had any groundwater law rulings from the Illinois Supreme Court since the 19th century.
Wow. So this, again, I think this is another important point here, that a way of approaching use and reasonable use, if the number of users is small, maybe that works okay. But as the number, I'm going back to the straws in the glass, you know, as you put more and more straws in the glass, then it becomes much more problematic.
That's exactly right. This is not a good system to control overall use. And I might add, by the way, that merely because you are tapping into a reservoir of water in which the water table is declining, that is, there's already overuse, that doesn't mean your use is unreasonable. I mean, it's not unreasonable per se to be contributing to the exhaustion of an aquifer. That's just one of the factors taken into account. But, I mean, a court might well say, well, you can it's okay if the groundwater level gradually declines, but we don't want any rapid decline because then people have to redrill their wells too often and put in new pumps, and that's a hardship.
Let's talk with some other folks. Champagne next, line one.
Hi, this is a little bit off the subject, but I think I understood you to say that disposing of unwanted materials that's not going to be retrieved is unregulated, and I just wanted to straighten that out. There are actually two kinds of disposal in Illinois, and Class 1 wells, which is disposal of hazardous materials, is regulated by the EPA, and they're very heavily monitored, and this fellow in Danville brings it up often. This well that was in Danville, it's actually greater than 6,000 feet deep, and they were disposing below 4,000 feet. And believe me, many trees die to make the monthly reports that are done on the monitoring of these wells. And I just wanted to clear that up.
Good. Yeah, you're certainly right. Yes, there's no doubt hazardous waste disposal everywhere is regulated, right?
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you. Let's go to another caller. This is line two, also in Champaign. Hello.
I had a question. I wondered, it sounds like the regulations on these issues are lagging way behind, obviously, the current level of awareness or scientific knowledge on, you know, how this stuff works. And I wonder where will those, there's a couple questions really, where will those laws be improved at county or state level, and where do the consumers need to apply, or I don't know, consumers is the right word, but the state residents need to apply pressure. And secondly, does the water company, the local water company, have some special rights that they, you know, some special agreement that they have with the county or the community or the state or whatever? And should those agreements, if there are some special ones, or large users, this is a number of questions, I'm sorry, large users, should they be subject to having some kind of a bond that says, you know, if your estimates and your usage turns out to cause a problem that we don't know about now, you're going to have, you know, a $5 billion surety bond or something to protect the state citizens. That's a lot of things there, but...
go ahead.
But let me dig into them. This doctrine of property law I've been talking about, the notion that your rights as landowner include the right to use water, I mean, that's a principle of state law. So if that were going to be changed, the logical place to change it would be at the state level. These are old rules of common law that we've inherited from generations ago. It is the one of the roles of the legislature to update these common law rules. And so it would be appropriate for the Illinois legislature to step in and do something about that. That said, I mean, keep in mind that water is viewed as part of the land. The reason you have the right to use surface and groundwater is because it's useful in fully using the land itself. So our legal system tends to view water use as an element of land use, and land uses are very much subject to regulation by various levels of government. Home rule jurisdictions have quite extensive land use regulatory power, but other jurisdictions, counties, cities, also have land use regulatory authority, and they could regulate usages of water just in the course of regulating land uses generally. With respect to the water company, I mean, public utilities, of course, are very heavily regulated. I mean, that's an entirely different body of law. If you engage in what's called a, you know, if you're a public utility, that triggers a lot of regulatory requirements. And that's a bit off the subject. But even the water company itself, though, their basic right to withdraw water from the ground rests upon landed property rights. They have to own land somewhere, and they are relying upon their own rights as landowners to extract the water. When you think about reform, though, one thing to keep in mind is that in our current system, all of the water of Illinois is allocated in a sense. In that the right to use water is attached to parcels of land throughout the state, and the state really hasn't held on to any water rights that it can give out on some other basis. I mean, so we couldn't suddenly set up a system where people would go to the state and the state would be giving them water rights independently of land. I mean, the state has no water to give away. So it would need to start off by redefining the kind of water use rights that people get when they acquire land. But it's entirely possible to do that. The elements of owning land generally are just set forth in law. These laws change like all other bodies of law, and there's no reason the legislature can't redefine that. I mean, there's some minor constitutional constraints on how far the legislature can go in redefining them, but they're not significant. I mean, there have been states around the country where legislatures have stepped in and prohibited all new groundwater uses just because this resource was being exhausted, and courts have routinely upheld the constitutionality of that. So I think the legislature has broad powers to redefine water rights, and that would be the logical place to start.
Okay, thank you. Right.
Well, let me just to make sure that I understand this, this business of the right to the water. If I go out and I buy a piece of property and I build a house and I drill a well, I have the right to pump water out of the well, and so I'm using that for just basic residential household use. The water company goes out, buys a piece of property, drills a well, and they set up a system and they supply water to Champaign-Urbana. Is my right to draw water just for myself for my household use equivalent to the right of the water company to draw water and to distribute it and to sell it? I mean, as far as the law is concerned, is the water company and are me and the water company the same?
Well, for starters, yes. You're both landowners. You both have the same water rights based upon land ownership. In one important way, you might actually have the superior claim because you are withdrawing water from your land and using it on your land. Hmm. The water company is withdrawing water from its land but pumping it for use elsewhere. So the old, really, our inherited common law system would give you very much a priority. If you are being harmed by what they are doing, they have to compensate you for your losses. That said, it is probably unlikely that a court is going to issue an injunction shutting down the municipal water system. I mean, yeah. That's just realistic. Your property rights may be violated. The normal remedy for a violation of property rights is a court order halting the violation. But that's subject to equitable discretion, and a court is not going to shut down a municipal water system just because of the public health implications of it. What they would likely do is say to the water company, they have to drill you a deeper well. They have to either hook you up for free to their water system, you know, give you an alternative water supply, or they have to pay the extra costs you incur in drilling your well deeper, and then maybe, you know, the lift charges, higher pumping costs. But sure, you could easily take them on directly.
And I guess I'm guess that this is sort of the same, but a little bit different. I'm just trying to think about the equivalent rights between an individual and their level of use, and say an industrial user. You know, mm-hmm. So supposing that again, it's the situation where somebody goes out and buys a piece of property and they drill a wall, mm-hmm. a well, and they build some kind of factory. Mm-hmm. And say they're using a lot of water, but they're using it on their property. So mm-hmm. so they're very clear it's equivalent. Sure. Say, oh, sure. An ethanol plant, for example, just to pull one, right, yeah. Just out of the air. Yeah. Then again, though, is the right equivalent between the individual household and now the sure, ethanol?
Sure.
Plant?
Yeah. These are great hypotheticals you're raising here. Your new hypothetical, though, you've shifted to an industrial use, hmm. And there's some old precedent in the law that prioritizes water uses. Which ones are the most socially important? And frankly, household uses are the highest priority period above everything else. And so you might rest on that. That it's unreasonable for an industrial user to come in and pump so much to interfere with household uses that you'd have priority. See, a municipal water system, they also can claim that it's mostly household uses, although obviously there's other water users in communities as well. So yeah. that would be it. It does make a difference, though, how deep your well is. This is much more of an issue in the American West. I mean, American West has a much more developed water law system generally because they've had arguments about water for 150 years. And in the groundwater law in the West, what they typically say is water users don't have a right to the protection of historic pumping levels. So if the water table is gradually going down, that might not be unreasonable. It could be unreasonable for you to insist on maintaining a very high water level. They could say to you, you've got to drill deeper and take it from a lower level. Because it's actually it can be inefficient to try to maintain a very high water table within an aquifer. You could end up not fully making use of it. But again, it's all a matter of reasonableness. Sure, you can offer as your plea that you're a little household who's just trying to get by. It's an effective argument.
About 10 minutes left perhaps in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Eric Freifogel. He is professor of law at the University of Illinois in the College of Law and is particularly interested in environmental law and natural resources law. And we're talking here about water resources and who owns them and how that use is regulated. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Given that the principle that guides us here is one that has been in place for a long time, came over from England, basically, as we've said, this idea that says you own the property, you have the right to use the resources that are underneath, governed by this sort of vague standard of reasonable use. I mean, given the fact that that's been in place for a long time, what are the chances that we're going to start to use some different way to think about this?
Okay. Let me actually correct what you said a bit. Illinois started off in the 19th century embracing a different rule of groundwater allocation, largely due to just the mysterious nature of groundwater law generally, because people didn't understand how water moved underground. That Illinois was one of the states that adopted what's referred to as the absolute ownership rule, meaning you have the right to pump as much water from your land and use it on your land as you want without regard to any notion of reasonableness. The legislature stepped in, when was it, 30 years ago? For some reason, 1983, it pops in my mind. That may not be the right year. And in essentially a one-sentence statute, shifted Illinois over to the reasonable use approach. So all uses have to be reasonable. But the notion of a reasonableness in water use has been around for a long time, and it was part of our surface water riparian rights law for a long period of time. Are we likely to change this? Of course we are. This system doesn't protect groundwater sources. It doesn't protect against excessive withdrawals. It doesn't ensure that the water uses that we allow are those that are most socially beneficial or economically productive. It is not a good way to allocate water. And it's also not a good way, though, to unleash the market in a sense, because at the moment it isn't clear that people who have water rights that attach to their land, that they can sell their water rights to anybody else unless they just sell their land and somebody comes in and uses the water on the land. So we need to build into the system some method for controlling uses overall and then ensuring that water water gets allocated over time to those uses that are most beneficial. The current system gets a failing grade on that completely. And at some point, pressure will build and the legislature will do something.
So this is something that they would have to make a decision on in Springfield. New law would have to be written.
Sure. You can think about local governments trying to step in and regulate this. But you know, water moves around. It doesn't respect jurisdictional lines, just like it doesn't respect property boundaries. And we need to think about water use patterns on large spatial scales. Even the state of Illinois, of course, is not necessarily a large enough spatial scale. We have a lot of rivers that cross boundaries. Again, that hasn't been a big issue in Illinois and this part of the country much. But goodness, it's a huge issue in the West, is allocating water in rivers that cross state boundaries. Those cases go to the U.S. Supreme Court all the time. It's a huge issue internationally. I mean, just think about rivers in the Middle East that cross national boundaries. Interstate water allocation is a big, big issue.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Champaign. They're on the cell phone. This is line one. Hello.
Okay. Good morning. I thank you for the program. It's a vital issue, certainly, since water is a finite resource. Does the matter of leasing land change the use of the right to use water? That's question number one. And then question number two, is there any satisfactory way laws protect the contamination of water sources that make it impotable? I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Sure. Because a water use right is part of the land, if you're leasing land, you would get the right to use water as part of your lease. I mean, unless the lease said otherwise. So sure, that's a pretty easy question. You know, the landlord, the lessee, can restrict the water uses, of course, but otherwise they would presumably come with the land itself. As for contamination, goodness, the possible sources of contamination are quite many. Obviously, groundwater is most easily contaminated by activities that take place within the recharge area. I mean, there's somewhere in the world there is rainwater hitting the surface that's going to percolate down and work its way into a particular aquifer. It might take a long time. I mean, as many people realize, that groundwater can sometimes move very, very slowly underground, and it can take years. It can take centuries. It can take thousands of years for water to get to where it is. I mean, there's still groundwater that's coming up, being pumped up today, that is essentially ice melt from the last ice age, for heaven's sakes. It's been underwater slowly, underground slowly moving. I like that. A lot of surface land uses, of course, can have contamination. Contamination can leak out, you know, from ash pits, for instance, or other storage. It's, I mean, if you really want to protect all groundwater sources, you have to really think about regulating a lot of activities. That's particularly true in recharge areas that have loose sandy soil of some sort, where contaminants really can leak down pretty quickly. Petroleum is obviously a terrible contaminant.
Well, is it clear whose business it is to look out for that
No, it's not. It's not clear whose business that is. I say the federal, there is a Safe Drinking Water Act that does protect source areas somewhat, but it typically does so only around the wellhead themselves. Sometimes that's effective. Sometimes it provides no benefit whatsoever. I mean, I will say that when water moves very slowly underground, taking years or centuries to go along, there is an ability to clean itself. So a lot of the impurities, contaminants disappear. So it's typically a good thing that your water's been underground for a long time.
All right, one more call at least. Someone in Marion, line number two. Hello.
Hello there. Thank you very much. This might be a little bit askew, but I have a piece of property in southern Illinois, and I tried to it's a small piece of property, and I needed to get water from the municipality and the sewage system, but it took them several months to get it to me, and I was not allowed to drill my own well on my land and put in my own septic system, and I'm just wonder what laws prevent me from doing that, because I feel like because of being held up so long, I lost several hundred dollars, and I feel like I could manage my water better than the water company. It'd be cheaper in the long run, the same with the sewage system.
Sure. Yeah. I don't really know the answer to that. I assume it's some local land use regulation. As I said earlier in the show, using water is just a type of land use, and any government that's got the authority to regulate land uses could regulate your use of water as part of, you know, package of regulating other land use activities. Waste disposal raises different issues because that's sort of a contamination pollution issue. It is very common for counties, municipalities to restrict septic fields, you know, minimum lot size, construction standards, often prohibiting them entirely in areas where there's just too great of a risk of them contaminating water. I mean, runoff from septic systems, malfunctioning ones, is a pretty serious water pollution issue in many parts of the country. Very serious in some, because these septic fields, no matter how well constructed and well designed, they break down. And they need to be inspected. They need to be repaired. And it's one of the areas where the state has really fallen down, I think. It is very reluctant to step in and come up with a rigorous inspection program for septic fields and to make sure that they're all functioning. It's, I guess, just too politically sensitive to take it on or something. But I'm guessing that you're talking about local land use regulation.
That's correct, yes. Yes. Thank you very much. I really have appreciated the program.
All right, thank you. Well, we are at the point where we really have to stop. And I apologize. We have one more caller here. I think we really don't have the time to take the call. I'm sure we'll in future try and get back to some of these things. And we will be talking some more about water use in the next part of the show as we talk with Robert Glennon about his new book, Looks at America's Water Crisis. Any sort of last thought real quick you'd like to leave with folks?
I think it's good for citizens to take an interest in water. You know, a legislature doesn't address problems unless the voters or citizens out there that press them to do it. And we really are overdue for some serious change in both our surface and groundwater law. We've got to come up with a better system. Unfortunately, the politics are such that if a momentum gets going and the legislature takes it on, there's going to be a real danger that the major water using interest in the state come in, take over the process, and just sort of divide the water up among themselves, paying little attention to the ecological health of our waterways, long term conservation, paying little attention to sort of the small users and so on. So it's I would love to see a legislative initiative get going, but I'd be terrified by it.
All right. There we will leave it. Our guest is Eric Freifogel. He's Max L. Rowe Professor of Law at the University of Illinois College of Law, has written widely on environmental law, conservation law, natural resources law. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.